Thanks everyone for coming to the 9 a.m. edition. Are there any questions from Lesta? Okay. So last time we talked about the cosmic neutrino background and neutrino decoupling. And today I'll start by talking about saying a little bit about dark matter. I want to start by just sort of saying what is required to match observations. One challenge as I give these lectures is that I have to present things. It's hard to really talk about the observations until you've built up some machinery. So when I'm starting out and we haven't built up much machinery yet, then I have to be a little hand-wavy about the observations and just sort of saying what they require without saying much about how the observations work. I just want to say that to be consistent with like the CMB and other cosmological datasets, it appears that we need a dark sector with two components. There's what I'll call a light sector. And there, the observational requirements can be stated as follows. So mainly to avoid screwing up the CMB, you need some light species which are still relativistic at temperatures of around 1 eV when the CMB is formed. There's a fairly precise measurement of the energy density at temperatures of order in eV, which is quoted as a effective number of neutrinos. I talked about that parameterization last time. I don't really like this parameterization because it suggests that it's neutrino specific when it's really just a constraint on the number of relativistic decoupled degrees of freedom at when the temperature is of order in eV. And then the third thing that's known is that this component can't be a large fraction of the energy density today. On the face of it, it could be large if the particle mass was high, like say of order a few hundred millielectron volts. I left off a zero here. But roughly, it has to be like a sub percent contribution today, which in the case of neutrinos, a fermion with 2 degrees of freedom and 3 species means that the sum of the neutrino masses needs to be below 120 MeV. So this light sector, all the observational constraints are met by standard model neutrinos. And the ineffective constraint means that there's not much room to add anything else. So it's natural to assume that that's all there is to the light sector. And then second, a heavy sector, which is what's called cold dark matter. Where the observational constraints are as follows. We need some species which are already non-relativistic fairly early in the universe when the temperature is a few keV, something like 5 keV. Now, in most dark matter models, the temperature when the species goes non-relativistic is the same scale as the particle's mass. This is usually stated in the literature as the requirement that the particle mass be above around 5 keV. But there are examples of freeze-in type scenarios or non-thermal mechanisms where these two scales are related in a different way. And then it's really I'm just trying to emphasize that it's really the time when the species goes non-relativistic that is constrained. That's usually the same thing as the particle mass. We have a very accurate measurement of the abundance today. That's around 0.27. About 6 times the mass that's in standard model particles. And then finally, I guess I'll squeeze it onto this blackboard. So that's about it. The other thing is that there are a lot of upper bounds on interactions with the standard model. Just a way of saying that no one's ever detected yet an interaction with standard model particles. And if that ever were detected, it would just be like a huge breakthrough. Despite a lot of attempts to look, like direct detection experiments where you get a big tank of xenon and put it underground in a mine to shield it from backgrounds and look for dark matter particles coming through and bouncing off the xenon nuclei. Okay, so it's natural to wonder, given the success of this thermal history in explaining the light sector, it's natural to wonder whether it can explain the heavy sector as well. By the way, I forgot to say that this first property that the dark matter goes non-relativistic early, and so it has like small velocities today, is what's meant by the cold in cold dark matter. And if you're thinking about a dark matter model where that's not true, and dark matter has large thermal velocities, and then your model would be called warm dark matter or hot dark matter. But those models are pretty ruled out with modern data. Okay, so it's natural to ask whether we can explain dark matter as a thermal relic. And the challenge is that from everything that we've said so far, it sounds tough. So you may recall, we're trying to match two constraints, the constraint that the mass has to be large, and the abundance today has to be order one. And you may recall that for neutrinos, let's say one species, those parameters are related in a way that makes it hard to match both constraints. So for neutrinos, if I make the mass of order a few keV, then I'll get a huge omega, something on the order of 10 to the 3. And in other words, I'll overpopulate the universe with dark matter. And just to draw a picture of why the challenge exists, so I'm going to draw this plot. But now I'm going to say that the axes are scale factor and number density. The number density goes as axes here are neutrinos and photons. I'm just trying to draw a picture that sort of explains where this constraint comes from. Before neutrino, or before E plus E minus annihilation, the density of both species goes as A to the minus 3. And then there's a little bit of an enhancement. You can show that the number density of photons goes up by 11 fourths without the 1/3 at E plus E minus annihilation. But up to this constant factor, for a thermal relic like neutrinos, it would appear that the number density has to be the same as the CMB number density today. And so if we start giving the neutrinos a large mass, just picture some bath of neutrinos whose number density is fixed, then there's no way to avoid making the total energy of the neutrino background large. And the only mechanism we've introduced to sort of make things better would be to move decoupling further back when G star was larger and there are more annihilation events. But that only helps by some, modest constant factor, some ratio of G stars. And there's no real good way of getting up to a factor of 1,000.
The plot we drew was in terms of temperature with A, right?
Last time I was plotting, temperature with A. This time I'm plotting number density versus A, which goes as A to the minus 3. There is, however, one direction that we haven't explored, which is that this picture assumes this is the correct picture for a species which is still relativistic when it decouples. So if a species is, it's hard to meet this challenge with a so-called hot relic. Which means still relativistic at decoupling. Let's suppose we consider a cold relic, meaning a non-relativist has started to go non-relativistic at decoupling. Then what will happen is that the abundance of the relic starts to exponentially drop. It starts to participate in annihilation. And then if its abundance doesn't all go all the way to zero and then it decouples, I'll draw this part of the curve as e to the minus m over t. If the abundance doesn't go all the way to zero, then at some point it decouples, the abundance freezes out, and it starts going as a to the minus 3. And we can get a big, like, parametric suppression, some exponential factor, which can allow the mass to be large. You know, it could be 100 GeV or something. And because this is an exponential suppression, there's still room to match the observed abundance. So this is still the prevailing, you know, most popular theoretical idea for where dark matter may have come from, is that there's two cases for relics that can be hot or cold. Viewed that way, this observed dark sector starts to look kind of natural. We're just saying that we have one of each, or at least one of each, in our standard model. I want to calculate in a little bit of quantitative detail what happens in this kind of scenario. So I'm going to consider a toy model. The goal is to calculate the relic abundance today in omega in terms of the parameters of the model, which are going to be a cross section and a particle mass m. And by the cross-section, I mean the annihilation cross-section. There's some reaction which converts a dark matter particle chi and its antiparticle to standard model particles. And I'm going to calculate in the approximation of instantaneous freeze-up, meaning that the picture is going to look something like this. The number density is going to go like a to the minus 3. And it'll start to exponentially freeze out, exponentially annihilate. There'll be some, I'm just going to assume that it instantaneously switches over from this thermal, annihilating thermal behavior to a decoupled particle, where the time of freeze out I'll calculate by setting the interaction rate equal to h. I'll start by calculating the I'll start by calculating the decoupling temperature, T star. By setting lambda equal to h. Lambda, as in the case of the neutrino background, is going to be the number density of the chi particles. Chi is interacting with itself to annihilate, times the cross section times the typical velocity. And then I'm going to sort of go over here to do side calculations. So for the number density, I'm going to use this expression for a thermal species. And I'm interested in this expression. I'm assuming that the decoupling happens when the particle is non-relativistic. I'm going to be interested in this expression in the non-relativistic limit, where c is smaller than m. In that limit, you can show that you get this number density with the exponential suppression, regardless of whether the particle is a boson or a fermion. And for purposes of this calculation, which is all going to be at tilde level, I'll just forget about the two pi's and the g and write it like this. Over here for the n, I'm going to stick in g to the 3/2 z to the pi sine over t. For the sigma, I'll just leave that alone. That's just like one of my model parameters. And then for the v, in the neutrino decoupling calculation, that was 1. But here I'm assuming non-relativistic. So I'll just set the kinetic energy equal to t and conclude that v is of order t over m to the 1/2. And then I'll just write that as for the expansion rate h, the background is still radiation dominated, so I'm going to do the same thing that I did in the neutrino case. To relate rho to the temperature, I'll write it as g star times t to the 4th. And then I'll just forget about all the constant factors and write this as gt to the 4th to the 1/2. Or t squared over m Planck. Writing 8 pi g is 1 over m Planck squared. So then decoupling occurs. And lambda is of order h. Or equivalently, gamma is of order h. And so setting these equal, you read off that e to the minus m over t v1 over sigma m m plus. We call that e to the minus t m over t star, where t star is the decoupling temperature. By the way, a little detail here is that in the neutrino case, the decoupling temperature was arose from comparing two power laws. We found that the interaction rate when it's t to the 5th and the Hubble rate when it's t squared. And here there's this exponential. So the decoupling is driven not by the temperature dependence of the interaction strength, but it's driven by this exponential fall off. Once the the number density starts to decay exponentially, there are just fewer dark matter particles around to find each other and annihilate. I sort of mentioned this because you might think that the cold relic scenario involves some fine tuning, that there's sort of this. The way that I drew it here, it looks like you have to tune the freeze-out temperature to be after the particle has started to go non-relativistic, but in a narrow window where it hasn't annihilated completely yet. And it's not really a fine-tuning. Like the coupling to the plasma can be really high when it starts to annihilate. And even if there's a huge cross-section, eventually the number density will dilute to the point where it freezes out. Okay. I'm going to define x to be m over t star. I'm assuming x is much larger than one. That's the condition for non-relativistic at freeze-out. If I get to the end of the calculation and I found that x, that this was not the case, then the calculation would not be self-consistent. X can't be too large because it appears here in an exponential. So for example, if I take m to be on the order of 1 TeV and sigma to be on the order of 10 to the minus 8, just some sort of typical beyond standard model parameters, then x would be around 30. In the dark matter literature, for some reason, this range is often quoted as being the plausible range. I'm not sure exactly where these numbers come from. But the point is that when the symbol x appears, it's not something that's allowed to be 10 to the 10 or something, because it appears in this exponential. It's the log of something. Okay. Then next I'll calculate the relic abundance. I want to calculate the number density, or the energy density today. I'll write that as the particle mass times the number density today. And then, let's see. I'm going to relate abundances today to abundance when the freeze-out occurred. The way that this type of thing often happens in cosmology calculations, and so the way that usually works is that here I've written the abundance today as the abundance at freeze out, or number density, times a star cubed, and then what I want to do is convert that to a factor of the C and B temperature. Because entropy is conserved, I know that A star is roughly the C and B temperature over the temperature at freeze-out. More accurately, that's true up to factors of G star. So here's the condition for entropy conservation between the freeze-out and today, when G is 2 and A is 1. And then if I write that, if I solve this for A star, get this. So I can write equals there and not tilde. And then because this is a back of the envelope calculation, I'll just replace this by TCMB over T star.
Why did we start with 2 CMB star?
Sorry?
Why did we start with 2 CMB star? This is like entropy conservation. S small s into A cube should be same as...
Oh, yes, yes. So in general, the... You write this as G star decoupling and G star s today.
Oh, I see.
A today, yeah. Cubed times TCMB. And then today we just have the photon with G equals 2, G star equals 2. And A is 1. Okay. And I'm going to plug in, this should have been T star downstairs. And then for n star, I'll plug in this expression for the number density at freeze-out. And then after a little algebra, you could write it this way. What's interesting about this calculation is that the energy density today, that's the 0.27 that we're trying to match, can be written in terms of things that we know, TCMB and M Planck, multiplied by this factor of x to the 3/2, which we don't know, but it's not allowed to vary over too large of a range, so we know it's order of magnitude. Times 1 over sigma with no dependence on the dark matter particle mass. So that the abundance today just roughly converts to a value of sigma. If you put in the units, so if I write this as omega C for cold dark matter, cesium, rho today over the total energy density of the universe, which we know today from measuring the Hubble expansion rate and using Friedmann's equation. And I plug in all the numbers, then I get something like this. That is to explain the observed abundance around 0.25 with an x that's around 30. I need an interaction cross-section, which is of order of the electroweak scale. And this is sometimes called the WIMP miracle, where WIMP means a weakly interacting massive particle. But starting from this calculation, which just involves cosmological things, like the numbers that went in are things like the CMB temperature and the strength of the gravitational interaction and the observed Hubble rate today. Then we do this calculation to figure out what cross-section the dark matter would need to have. And the electroweak scale naturally comes out. So that's a very interesting thing about the calculation. I guess I'd want to say it's like a good thing. It tells us what cross-section we need to look for if you're doing a direct detection experiment or something. The fact that the particle mass has canceled out of the calculation, or rather mostly canceled out, like the particle mass still affects the value of x a little bit, but that can't vary over too large of a range, means that the abundance gives us like no real idea of what the mass might be. Now, as I said before, there's this other constraint from the observations that the particle mass, we think, has to be above 5 keV. But that's a pretty weak constraint. That leaves us a lot of room to look. I meant to say something about where this constraint comes from, how we know that dark matter has to be cold. So even though I can't really do justice to it, let me just sort of draw like a little picture. So if you imagine some dark matter, let's say this is a space-time diagram of some dark matter. And let's say the dark matter is cold, so it doesn't have much velocity dispersion, and the world lines of the dark matter particles all line up. Then it's easy, so to speak, for the dark matter to gravitationally collapse. If I put in a little potential well, a little perturbation in the dark matter density, then this is sort of a very organized stream that can easily cut sort of combine coherently into some collapsed art object, a so-called dark matter halo, where galaxies could later form. But if I make the dark matter a mess, I give it a large velocity dispersion, then this gravitational collapse is kind of an organized process. And if the particles are just free streaming around all over the place, then they don't tend to fall into potential wells, and the dark matter halo won't form. So the point of the cartoon is that adding velocity dispersion in the dark matter tends to suppress the formation of gravitational structures. A little more quantitatively, you can't really form structures whose escape velocity is larger than the velocity dispersion of the particles you put in. And so if you, this value of 5 keV is the maximum amount of velocity dispersion that's consistent with like all of the small structures that we see in the universe, like all the little galaxy clusters whose mass is too large. Okay. I will say that there's also an upper limit. So if you're a particle physicist, you might want to know like what sigma and what m should I be looking for in my dark matter experiment. There's also an upper bound. You'll find in the literature the statement that the dark matter has to be less than 100 TeV. And this is sometimes called the unitarity bound. Now, I have to admit that I forgot to put this in my notes, and I'm just remembering up here that I should tell you about it. So I'm not prepared to give a proper derivation of this. But roughly the way it works, the rough idea, is that there's a bound in QFT for how large a cross-section can be before you start to get negative probabilities. So if I send in two particles, then if I compute the cross-section to all outgoing states, then it can't be so large that the probability of the particles passing through each other is negative. And when you put in the kinematic factors, so I remember how the answer turns out. The answer is that the just cross-sections in QFT as a general theorem have to be less than 4 pi over the particle mass squared. The 1 over m squared is dimensional analysis, and the 4 pi comes out of some kinematic factors. Now, if you put in the sigma that we computed and solve for m chi, then you get an upper bound on m chi, and that's this unitarity bound. And so that's generally regarded as a pretty hard upper limit on how large the mass of a dark matter particle can be. Although there's also
it's infinite.
That's right. So the range is huge, right? I will say there's also like a theorem in physics that any sort of bound you find, some particle physicist will like find a way to evade it. And there are ways of pushing this up a little higher by like, this bound sort of assumes the so-called S-wave annihilation, where the cross-section is not very dependent on the direction of the outgoing particles. So there's some like games you can play with making the scattering very collimated to make the push the unitarity bound up by like a factor of a few. Anyway, so if you read like sort of modern papers on dark matter, they will say that the dark matter could be, you know, more or less anywhere in this range. There's like a lower bound from cosmological structure formation, and an upper bound from the requirement that like probabilities have to add up to 1 without getting negative probabilities. If you read older papers on dark matter, I'm sort of telling the story backwards. They'll tell a different story where the appearance of the electroweak scale, it sort of inspired people to think that the dark matter must have something to do with electroweak physics. And therefore, its cross-section should have this sort of general form, like some order 1 number, times the Fermi constant squared, times the like square of the energy scale of the scattering. We had this formula up on the board before when we were talking about neutrino decoupling. And so if this is your assumption, and this is sometimes what people mean when they say WIMP, weakly interacting massive particle means that the interaction has something to do with the weak scale. So if this is your assumption, where there's some order 1 constant hidden here, then if you plug in the sigma and solve for m chi, then you get some range of allowed masses, which I'll write roughly like this. I'm being a little sloppy because I forgot to put any of this in my notes, and I'm kind of like telling you what I remember. So In the older literature, meaning before around 2010 or so, you sometimes, you know, the story that you usually saw is that dark matter lives somewhere in the M sigma plane, where we know sigma pretty well from cosmology. It, you know, has to be somewhere around 10 to the minus 7 GeV to the minus 2. And then just because the Wimp miracle is so compelling, and we think that dark matter probably has something to do with electroweak physics, the mass of the dark matter particle should be somewhere between 10 GeV and there's sort of a natural box where we should look with direct detection experiments. But the problem is, and this is why the story changed around 2010 or so, is that that box is like has really been, and indeed in 2010, you know, I was doing cosmology and I thought like, oh, this story, it just makes so much sense, and the direct detection experiments are going to find dark matter like any day now. But what actually happened is that the upper limits on sigma kept getting better and better. And now they're sort of down here. So the direct detection experiments were designed to cover this mass range. So the constraints get weak at low and high mass. The upper limit now is, you know, something like a factor of 100 to 1,000 below like the natural target.
And this is the detection.
Yeah. So like this curve means that like points below the curve are allowed by the experiments.
Okay.
So the modern perspective on dark matter is to say, well, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. And there's a few possible directions in which it might have been wrong. One is that, you know, maybe we took the Wimp miracle too seriously when we wrote this down. And we should just enlarge the mass range to go all the way from like 100 TeV down to you know, something like 5 keV. Indeed, there's lots of new experiments popping up now that are not optimized for this WIMP mass range and are exploring the edges. And then there are some like particle physics loopholes for keeping the mass in this range but lowering the cross section. So like one loophole is that so this cross section is computed in the early universe when velocities are high. You know, more precisely, the velocity of the dark matter is of order x to the 1/2. Sorry, 1 over x to the 1/2. You know, so the dark matter particles might have been moving at 20% of the speed of light or so. Whereas nowadays in the dark matter experiments, you know, we're sort of at the mercy of our velocity in the cosmic rest frame as dark matter particles pass through the detector. A typical astrophysical velocity might be on the order of 10 to the minus 3 C. So if the cross section just had some velocity dependence, like say it goes as V squared or something, then it might have been high in the early universe, but low, you know, it would look low in the experiments today. Another possible loophole is that the sigma that we compute here, you know, is just the total interaction cross section with like all particles in the standard model, whereas the experiments are looking for some specific interaction like with protons and neutrons. So by fiddling with branching ratios, you could try to arrange, you know, try to arrange the physics so that the interaction cross section with like protons is small. So the point is, we don't really know. You know, it's kind of like Gong's Easter egg hunt. Like you look in the most obvious places first, and then you don't really know where to look next. So we don't really know whether we should be looking out here, or looking out here, or down here. But there are, you know, experiments that are exploring all directions. And you know, I tend to be an optimist. I still find the thermal relic story compelling. And this is just my hunch, but I optimistically predict that dark matter will show up in the lab in the not too distant future. The flavor of the subject has changed a bit from, you know, looking in a well-defined box to kind of a fishing expedition of exploring many directions at once.
So that means more means the earlier idea was that dark matter would have some weak interactions and therefore sigma would be something like that.
Yeah, like, so in hindsight, I think, you know, these are really the statements we can make that are pretty solid. And this was more of a speculation. Okay. So, way off track. I meant to only talk about dark matter for about 20 minutes, but it's fun to talk about dark matter. So, yeah, it took about 45 minutes. So the last thing I want to do is, you'll recall that we started talking about thermal history. I said there were roughly three types of thermal history events that I wanted to cover, like the annihilation events, where we have a very systematic understanding. Decoupling events, where I think the same is true. We talked about the two cases, a species which is relativistic or non-relativistic at decoupling. And then finally, there are what I'll call binding events, where as the universe cools, a bound state of two particles becomes thermodynamically favored. So I just want to do one example. These tend to be a little messier to calculate. But I just want to do one example. So the examples that come to mind are hydrogen recombination, or the cooling of the plasma from protons and free protons and electrons to neutral hydrogen at a redshift of around 1,000, and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, or the cooling of a plasma of protons and neutrons into a plasma of protons and helium nuclei. You know, this at a temperature of 0.3 eV when the CMB is formed, and this at a temperature of around the 5 eV. So I'm going to talk about hydrogen recombination. Okay. So let me just say first how the answer is going to come. So what we're going to find is that there's only going to be one interaction in the problem, which is going this way. It's the, you know, capture of an electron by a proton to form a neutral hydrogen atom, emitting a photon at the binding energy, which is 13.6 eV. Or going the other way, you know, the spontaneous decay of a hydrogen atom into a hydrogen atom captures a photon. You could think of the photons coming in and knocking out an electron, disassociating it into a proton and an electron. The thermal state of the universe can be represented by its ionization fraction, X sub e. And what will happen is that it's initially close to 1. And then at a certain point, around 0.3 eV, it starts to exponentially decay. It drops very, very quickly. And then it goes constant again at a lower level, around 10 to the minus 3. The math here will look a lot like dark matter freeze up, where the abundance is exponentially starts to exponentially suppress at some energy scale, and then there's an interaction that freezes out to leave behind some small exponentially suppressed relic abundance. Okay. I'll set this calculation up, but I won't really get to do it till next time. I'm going to ignore helium and excited states of hydrogen. So these species are the only species in the problem. And in particular, I'll treat hydrogen as a species with H equal to with G equal to 4. In the ground state of hydrogen, the proton and the electron each are spin 1/2. They have two states each. I'm going to assume that the universe, I'm going to solve for the abundances or number densities of all four of these species. I'm going to assume that the universe is electrically neutral. And then finally, that baryon number is conserved. First, these statements follow from the statement that this is the only interaction that I'm considering, but I just want to write down some equations that capture that. So the little abundance of H plus P, I'll call that NB, the baryon number density. And that goes as a^-3. Since I'm going to plug in numbers in the end, it's I worked out the numerical value of the baryon density today. Here I took the total energy density of the universe, which we measure, you know, indirectly by measuring the expansion rate and using Friedmann's equations, and then I multiplied by the baryon fraction to get a mass in baryons, and then I divided by the proton mass to get a number of baryons. And that is, turns out, okay. And then I'm going to assume that that photons are just a black body, a fixed black body. Whose number density in the first part of the calculation, I'm going to keep track of like constant factors. Where T is the and photon density today is UMB temperature 410. So this is really an approximation. I'm saying that the photons have the same number density that they would have if they were just free streaming unperturbed by the recombination process. I'm just sort of treating photons as like this bath of particles where I don't have to keep track of how many photons are coming in and out of the bath. Of course, recombination, you know, that's an approximation. Recombination is both a source and sink of photons. But it's a good approximation, as you can appreciate, by computing the baryon to photon ratio. That ratio is constant in time because both numerator and denominator go as a^-3. And taking the ratio of these numbers, you get like 6 × 10⁻¹. Okay. Let's see. Maybe it's kind of a natural place to stop because the next little bit is kind of, you know, a calculation that'll take 10 or 15 minutes. So maybe I'll just stop here by just putting the assumptions of my toy model for recombination on the board. And then I'll come back tomorrow and analyze it. And it'll be very similar to dark matter, where there's a thermal equilibrium phase where things exponentially suppress and then things freeze out to a constant. So I'll stop here for today. Are there any questions?
I wanted to ask about when people in observations, when they're looking for dark matter, the like we said that we have to look for, means like older times we had that we have to look for sigma and m in this ratio. So how do in observations that map out, means in the sense to compute any cross sections, you have to assume what forces it's interacting. So, and usually at least the popular thing is that dark matter is not very interacting with any of the three forces. So is the sigma has some gravitational input, or we assume a weak interaction and then compute the cross section and try to match?
Oh no, what's actually measured in the experiments is the cross section with, or at least in the direct detection experiments, is the cross section with some standard model particle, like usually a proton.
So, but the, like, what the equation for the interaction would just be some, like we wrote, x, x bar to give protons or something like that.
Yeah, it would be like, you know, the cross section with a proton. And I guess the other thing that you need to know to interpret that measurement is, you know, in addition to which particle the cross section is with, the proton, is like the relative velocity of the two particles. And that's always of order 10 to the minus 3, because that's like the astrophysical velocity of dark matter particles coming through the Earth.
And maybe we're talking about the gravitational, means the way we say that there has to be this amount of dark matter, are the spinning curves or something like that, right? Where we see that the rotational velocity of galaxies is much.
Oh yeah, yeah. So that was sort of the first observation that was hard to explain, that motivated astronomers to speculate that there might be dark matter. I think the history is complicated, but Franz Zwicky around 1970 is usually kind of gets the credit for putting that forward. And then over time, you know, it was seen in like a, you know, wide variety of observations that things don't work unless you put in dark matter at an appropriate density. Like nowadays, in the CMB, if you try to calculate the CMB power spectrum without putting in any dark matter, then you end up like, you know, 100 sigma off what you actually measure. That's probably like the cleanest observation, because the CMB really just depends on, like, you know, the power spectrum can mostly be calculated just using like linear perturbation theory. It's really like there's no astrophysical messiness but it's not actually the strongest constraint. The strongest constraint nowadays is just the abundance of bound structures in the universe. So observations which are sensitive to that, like just like the amount of gravitational lensing in the universe, give the best constraints on dark matter. That's more or less where the 5 keV constraint comes from.